You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. Will Germany's Grand Coalition reform after all? My guests Michael Binion and Michael Goldfarb will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including how happy Syrians should be that their future is being decided by the presidents of Russia, Turkey and Iran, whether Jeff Sessions, of all people, might be willing or able to impose some measure of sanity on American gun laws, and the UK's increasing understanding of what Brexit is actually going to mean. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times, and Michael Goldfarb, the journalist and broadcaster. Welcome both. Now, reports of the political mortality of German Chancellor Angela Merkel may have been exaggerated after days of somewhat gloating conjecture following collapse of talks to form a new governing coalition. It appears that her previous partners, the Social Democrats, may yet be strong-armed into resuming the relationship. Germany's President Frank-Walter Steinmeier, himself a member of the Social Democrats, has been meeting with the party's leader, Martin Schulz. You're both called Michael. That's going to make life tricky, isn't it? I've just realised that. Michael Binion, first of all, why didn't the Social Democrats want to be in government in the first place? It is surely preferable to being in opposition.
Yes, but the last time round that they were in government, they lost so heavily and they were tarred with the whole accusation that they were just voting partners for Angela Merkel's policies, and they couldn't really profile themselves distinctly from the Christian Democrats. And that is the problem, sadly, for all minority parties in a coalition, that they are driven by what the leader of the majority party wants and what the majority party does, and they thought they better stay out, particularly as they'd lost very heavily in the last election. They lost a lot of seats and were feeling pretty sore.
Michael Goldfarb, that is. Do I need to call one of you Mike? It doesn't seem appropriate.
Possibly.
We will figure this out over the next 28 minutes or so. But Michael Goldfarb, is what we're watching in Germany at the moment, everybody trying to adjust to what has changed in this Bundestag, which is, of course, the arrival on its benches of 90-odd, and I use the word odd in both senses, members of the Alternative for Deutschland party?
I think that that's part of it. I also think we here in Britain are perhaps not the beneficiaries of the best reporting on this issue, because it gets filtered in the primarily pro-Brexit press as an issue of, even Angela Merkel, who 2 weeks ago you said was the greatest thing, the only woman between us and the depths, can't even control her own country. It's not the case. I mean, this, as I understand it, it's a two-step thing that's happened. It's the other right-wing party that did extremely well at the expense of the Social Democrats, the FPD, and you can tell me if those are the wrong...
FDP.
Yeah. This is the Free Democrats.
Free Democrats. They're a younger party, and they may have overplayed their hand. They got very stubborn in negotiations.
This was the party who their leader, Christian Lindner, flounced.
He just flounced, literally. I mean, and that's a word, by the way, that the German press is using...
The Germans must have a better word for flouncing than flounced.
Well, I mean, if you read Deutsche Welle, which does a very good English summary of the news from Germany, they would not use the word flounce. It's probably not in their style book. But anyway, so that was phase one. Now that's happened. And then you have Angela Merkel saying, well, you know what? Let's have another election. Because I think she thinks that Alternative for Deutschland, the oddballs that you've described, and that's being polite about them, maybe like UKIP, have peaked, that they can't get more seats than this. And if people get a second chance to consider their votes, they might come back into the Christian Democrat, or at least into a normal right-wing party fold. The Social Democrats have, as Michael was saying, they lost a lot of seats, and they actually do need to figure themselves out again and possibly uncover some new leadership, just as, you know, the Liberal Democrats in this country, in the UK, paid a terrible price for kind of comping David Cameron. So what we've got is the Social Democrats' latest reporting is they'll go on a confidence and supply kind of arrangement where they won't really be in coalition, but will agree on key issues to back Merkel.
Michael Binion, on the subject of the coverage of this in Britain and outside Germany in general, has it been overblown somewhat, the scale of the crisis, if indeed that's what it is, by outlets which either don't understand German politics or understand that their readers don't really care about German politics and are therefore trying to make it desperately interesting? I note, researching this today on Deutsche Welle's own website, the top story on Deutsche Welle's own Germany page is not the government crisis in inverted commas, but it's about a cafe in Stuttgart banning sweatpants.
Well, I have to say, they would play it down, wouldn't they? After all, it is putting out the picture of Germany, which Germans are keen to emphasize to their trading partners especially, is very stable, very secure, and in fact the government carries on, things carry on as normal. Angela Merkel has been in office as caretaker chancellor ever since the day that she won the last election, or at least that she became leader of the majority party. But I think there is still a sense of crisis, because if you can't form a government, you do have a sense of where are things going, and there's some difficult decisions to be taken. If you are a fairly small country where your decisions usually don't affect your neighbours, then you can go on discussing a government for days, weeks and months, as indeed they did in the Netherlands or in Belgium, where they went for more than a year, in fact, without a government. But Germany matters, because it is by far the biggest and most important European and EU nation. And what they do in terms of policy will differ according to what the makeup of the minority parties that join in any coalition are. Now, as Michael said, the Free Democrats have been overplaying their hand. And the other ones, the Free Democrat and the Greens, are also in a slightly kind of fragile position. The feeling is that they've lost their ideological steam, so neither was really in a mood to compromise. And then Angela Merkel just thought a minority government is bad for Germany because it's unstable. And the one thing Germans are absolutely terrified of is instability. Anything that looks wobbly and like Weimar is anathema.
Well, just a final thought on this, Michael Goldfarb. Angela Merkel was saying earlier this week that she would rather another election than attempt to lead a minority government. Is it possible that that was quite a smart play by Chancellor Merkel, that she was basically calling everybody else's bluff?
I'm sure that's why she was so quick to say that. And I also think that it does give a sense that although the FDP did leave the talks or collapse the talks, it isn't a terminal thing. And I think that the fact that she came out, I think it was within 24 hours, and said, because there was a cycle of news saying, oh, now Germans don't want to have another election, blah, blah, blah. And she came out, works for me. And, you know, she still is the person in charge. And, you know, I don't think it will come to that. I think it is the necessary cold water being poured on all the parties who could potentially join the Christian Democrats, her party, in coalition. So I think there won't be another election, and I do think that we'll see a revival of talks.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Syria, the people of which have not been short of suffering these last few years. Even by those grim standards, however, it cannot be much fun to see the future of what remains of one's country being discussed and decided by Vladimir Putin, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and Hassan Rouhani, presidents of three countries whose motivations, where Syria is concerned, may be other than pure-hearted concern for the future welfare of its citizens. The three met yesterday in Sochi, following Putin's audience in the same location with President Bashar al-Assad of Syria. Michael Binion, first of all, is it weird that those meetings were separate? That first of all, Assad is summoned to Sochi, talks about whatever Assad and Putin talk about, and then is sent away before the other regional powers are invited?
Well, not really, because it's partly protocol and partly practical politics. Protocol, it certainly wouldn't work to have the leader of a government with which you are allied and helping being there when you're sort of discussing the future of that country over his head. And it does make it very difficult to actually speak frankly with both Turkey and Iran about what their motives are and what their aims are, which is what Putin wants to do. So you have a kind of courtesy call by Assad, at which Putin reassures him, no, 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 we're not going to sell you short. We are all going to back you, and we're looking for a framework for peace. Also, Putin can browbeat Assad quite hard and say, unless you are willing to be flexible and go to a new Geneva conference, we are going to carve it up without your consent. Because the Russians know that it's got to be a general kind of change of style if there's going to be any sort of peace in Syria. Now, what they're keen to do is cement their position in Syria, in other words, protect their port, their warm water port at Tartus, and stop Islamists gaining any foothold in the country. I actually think it may be a bit galling to have your country divided up by others, but actually the realpolitik of it is that that's the only way you're going to get peace in Syria. And these three are the three that control what's going to happen. It's all very well for America to harumph on the sidelines. America has absolutely no say in what goes on in Syria at the moment, and nor really does Western Europe.
Well, on that happy thought, Michael Goldfarb, do as far as it's possible to tell, if we look at these three countries, Russia, Turkey and Iran, where Syria is concerned, do they all actually want the same things?
They probably do in this respect. They don't want this conflict to continue because it ebbs and flows.
Indeed.
And the embers are still sufficiently warm that if a country chooses to blow on the embers in one part of Syria, you'll have the conflagration again. They've got rid of ISIS by and large. Beyond that, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think that it's pretty clear, I can say with some certainty, that what the Turks want is they want some backing from Russia to make sure that the YPG Kurds are put back in the box from which they came out to defeat ISIS. I'm sure that Iran wants to continue to have pretty much a free hand in Syria as well, and they have to have agreements about where and how and what the limits are of that should be. And, you know, Russia, in addition to Tartus, one of the most interesting things that I noticed just went by about 6 weeks ago, just before the Kurds in Iraq had their referendum, is Rosneft took out a huge stake in the oil fields around Kirkuk. And that oil comes through Turkey, through a pipeline built by the Turks to Ceyhan, and it also is now being trucked out by the Iranians. So all of this feeds in. These are all elements that need to be discussed. And I suppose the other element is what happens to Assad. I don't know to what degree Erdogan is invested in maintaining him. Is he a chip? I mean, just before we came in the studio, across my Twitter feed, I saw some Reuters copy out of Riyadh, Reuters news copy, saying, you know, the Saudis have been having a counter meeting, saying that there's no peace so long as Assad is still in post. So that's all up for discussion.
I don't think that Russians are tied forever to Assad. They made it pretty clear that for them, he's dispensable. What they don't want is his overthrow by a revolution or by a Western-backed insurgency, which inevitably would let in Islamists. They have made it quite clear that they would like the kind of regime to continue, so it could be someone else from the circle, but not necessarily him himself. And they've also told him he has to be flexible. They have waved the finger at him quite strongly several times, and they are not above just saying, if you don't go along with what we want, our arms support for you will be lessened.
Well, just to pick you up, Andrew, on something you said just in introducing the subject, and to pick up on Michael, what he just said about America not having much to say, is the next step, if they can make an agreement amongst these three regional powers and get rid of Assad even, is who's going to pay to reconstruct this country, which is devastated, you know, even beyond where Bosnia was? I mean, we're talking about World War II levels of devastation. Are they going to come to the West, to Western Europe, and to America, who have traditionally over the last 30 or 40 years been the bankers for post-conflict reconstruction most anywhere in the world? Are they going to get a welcome if they go to Washington and say, oh, have you got a spare $50 billion to rebuild the basics of Syrian society?
They wouldn't
society.
Get that if Assad is still in power, and that's another reason why I think he is probably in the long run dispensable. And they're going to do it through the kind of shadowed window dressing of another Geneva conference. They'll have elections, which of course he'll win, and then voluntarily he will step down, step aside in favour of a new...
Of somebody a bit like him, but not
exactly,
like him.
Exactly, his brother, perhaps. Or, no, somebody in the clan, or somebody like him, and he will have a sort of honorary retirement far away from Syria, probably somewhere in Russia.
Just to follow that up, finally, Michael Binion, Michael Goldfarb was mentioning earlier the fact that at least as a geographical entity, Islamic State appears to either no longer exist or to be on the verge of that. Now, that in itself is obviously excellent news, but is it possible that we may see, in a conflict which has, as we've been discussing, ebbed and flowed, that the defeat of a common enemy might actually open up new fronts or reopen them?
Oh, well, of course, yes, because then you've had this extraordinary alliance of everybody with everybody against ISIS. And you've had the Iranians working with the Americans, working with the Russians, working with the Turks, working with everybody.
Weirdly heartwarming in some
respects.
Exactly.
Now, they've all got different interests, and particularly the Iranians don't want to be seen with on the same side as the Americans, and vice versa. And the Saudis are very reluctant partners in this alliance. They're very keen to get rid of ISIS, but they don't really want to see anything that would legitimize Assad, because they were the leading proponents for his removal. And the Turks have done a volte-face. They've completely switched. They were the most vociferous to get rid of ISIS, and then they rather stupidly shot down a Russian jet, and that meant that they were subject to tremendous sanctions, which really hurt, and then they more or less swallowed their pride and came around saying, OK, Russia, you are the big power, we acknowledge that, we'll go along with trying to do a deal with you, Russia, and they'll allow Assad to be there for a while, but not for long.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Michael Binion and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next is the United States on the verge of entertaining common sense vis-a-vis gun control. Clue? No.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Michael Binion and Michael Goldfarb. Now, Jeff Sessions, the United States' as yet unindicted Attorney General, has ordered what he is pleased to call a comprehensive review of America's national instant criminal background check system. This is the mechanism which is supposed to prevent the more obviously unsuitable of potential gun owners from acquiring the kind of weaponry most countries only issue to soldiers, and even then after some thought. This follows this month's shooting in Sutherland Springs, Texas, in which 26 people were murdered by a gunman who, in theory, should not have been able to own the guns he did. Michael Goldfarb, the phrase comprehensive review, if you've spent enough time reporting on or working around politics, you understand what a comprehensive review is. This is an extremely complex, wide-ranging means of doing absolutely nothing, isn't it?
Yes. And it wouldn't do any good anyway, because today there was a report. I mean, you refer to the shooter in Sutherland Springs. He was well known in the Air Force for being unstable.
He had, in fact, been court-martialed.
And what happened was somehow those records got purged from the national computer base. So he just went around and got a hold of his guns when he should never have been sold anything. Today, it turns out that... in changing over a computer system, I think it was the FBI, lost 90,000 background checks. The system, you can't have a system for a country the size of the U.S. that will track everyone. Civil liberties people would argue, how do you know that it's only going to be used as background check material for purchasing a gun? No, it will never happen. And, you've given me the floor here on Thanksgiving Day. I think that everyone who is appalled by the gun carnage in the U.S., and I hope that's everyone who's listening to Monocle, should also understand that you're not going to get 300 million guns back. You're not going to change the culture. And you need to find a different way of regulating the sale of guns. Best way, of course, would be to ban assault weapons. They've tried that. I think they passed it briefly, but it had a 10-year time limit, and they let it lapse. But you're not going to change the gun culture. People will want to go out and buy guns. And there are so many guns out there. I remember just before I moved to this country in the mid-80s, you know, New York State put extra vigilance on gun sales. And all it meant was guys were driving down to North Carolina and coming back with boots full, trunk loads full of semi-automatics, sawed-off shotguns, anything they could get with no check down in North Carolina or South Carolina or anywhere in America. It's an impossible thing to police, and it's almost a waste of time.
Michael Binion, it's not the most depressing aspect of the Sutherland Springs story. The most depressing aspect of it, of course, is that 26 people were shot dead at church. But it is depressing, is it not, that the pro-gun lobby following it is actually trying to cling desperately to the fact that the killer, Devin Kelly, shouldn't have had access to guns. They're saying that their angle is that the law is fine. Obviously it's fine, because if it had been applied properly, he wouldn't have been able to buy those guns, because he had been court-martialed for various violent offences while he was serving with the United States Air Force. This isn't really an administrative question, though, is it?
No. I mean, the gun lobby, which is extremely powerful, has a lot of money and a lot of influence in Congress, as is very well known, has constantly come up with this mantra that it's not guns that kill people, it's people that kill people, and that you need to control bad people, and that, in fact, good people need guns to protect themselves from bad people.
Well, and again, that was an aspect of this case, that it does appear that he was prevented from causing further carnage by the proverbial good guy with a gun, which is something that almost never actually
happens.
Indeed.
I mean, the good guy with a gun is being hailed as a hero, and I suppose in the circumstances, he was a hero.
Entirely
because
rightly,
he stopped
yes.
the shooting. But the problem is that if you have people with guns, it's almost impossible to know how and where all the neighbours should be armed, because you don't know when an attack is going to come. Neighbours necessarily will be terrified that there may be some madman in their midst, and every time there is an incident like this, gun sales go up enormously, because everyone fears that they may find the same thing in their own village or church or anywhere.
Michael Goldfarb, does it seem weird to you, because this is the thing that struck me while I was looking into this prior to tonight's broadcast, that I don't know, I just vaguely thought Sutherland Springs seemed like something that happened, you know, months, even years ago. It was earlier this month, and not much longer before that, nearly 600 people were shot by one man in a parking lot in Las Vegas, and these things just seem to fade into the ether incredibly quickly.
Because they happen so frequently, but also, let's be clear, I mean, this is not on the subject of guns, but so long as you have... We're none of us used yet to the idea of who's president of this country. And you know, so long as he's tweeting constantly and we're constantly hooked into our various social media reading about him, is that he didn't? Are you crazy? I mean, all this week it's been about he's been feuding with the father of the latest NBA star, Lonzo Ball. He's been feuding with Lonzo Ball's father, was like the equivalent of a stage mother. I mean, he's become a national celebrity in his own right for being such a pushy dad. And they've been having this feud on Twitter. And you think, this is reality. And so, yes, an atrocity in which 26 people are killed worshiping in church. 58 people are shot at a country, killed at a country music festival in Vegas in one short autumn span. It just fades against this constant background of this whole country, which seems crazy, it is crazy, is run by a crazy person.
Well, on that Thanksgiving note, we will move along finally to the ongoing dawning of the realities of Brexit. The European Commission has declared that British cities will not, after all, be invited to compete in the 2023 European Capital of Culture contest, disappointing five British conurbations, which had already thrown their hats into this particular ring and had spent considerable sums on their bids. Michael Binion, by the rules, the technical letter of the law, as I understand it, this is probably fair enough in that Non-EU cities can enter, but they must be either cities in candidate countries or members of the EEA / EFTA. This is a bit petulant by the European Commission, isn't it?
It's a bit petulant, but what on earth did you expect? I mean, what did the British expect? They seem to want to cling on to all the little goodies that they could possibly salvage by saying, first of all, that it's not really just EU, it's just generally Europe-wide, and we're all part of Europe still. You know, we're not walking away from Europe, we're just walking away from the Union. And we like this because there's money involved, there's quite a lot of money involved. And clearly the British would like to get their hands on anything that's to their advantage, as long as it doesn't tie them politically or in any other way to the European Union. And the European Union is saying, sorry, you can't just have the sweets and the fun bits without being part of the whole show. And I'm not at all surprised. Actually, I think it's yet another thing trying to bring home to ordinary people in Britain what an absolutely disastrous idea it is to throw in the whole caboodle and say, we're out of it. We're having nothing to do with it. I mean, the real Brexiteer should say, great, you know, only we will decide which of our cities is cultured. We don't want those Europeans.
We can have a British capital of culture.
Why not?
I'm sure, actually, now that I've said that out loud, that's totally a thing that's going to happen. But Michael Goldfarb, the burghers of Dundee, Nottingham, Leeds, Milton Keynes and Belfast / Derry, are they entitled to their money back?
Did they put money in?
They have spent money on their bids, assembling their bids, making their pitches.
Well, no. I'm with Michael on this. Look, you know, everybody who is anything and has been, and up until last year, June last year, was spending money, whether they're businesses, the city, planning for a continuation of the status quo, isn't going to get their money back.
No.
And so, you know, I was particularly struck by two of those conurbations that you mentioned. Milton Keynes, for listeners who are not familiar with the English landscape, what is Milton Keynes? Milton Keynes is the butt of many a joke because it's a post-war new town, just kind of planned.
It's basically a British Canberra.
There you go. What is Canberra? Oh, I know what Canberra is.
Careful
but,
now.
But, you know, but the other city was Belfast, Derry. And of course, one of the major sticking points that has emerged
possibly
in the last
the month, major sticking point, in fact.
It will be. I mean, now there's another reason to move the border back to the Irish Sea, because then Belfast and Derry could like qualify and say, well, you know, we're still inside the customs union, and therefore we get to have it, and it's really important that we sustain our momentum in towards peace and political stability. As political instability is beginning to worm its way again into the devolved, it's not devolved anymore, government.
I think it's suspended. It's temporarily undevolved.
That's, I like that, temporary undevolvement. So, I mean, it would be jolly nice if this was a way of moving the border issue to a different footing. But I don't think that being City of Culture is important enough to Michel Barnier or David Davis.
No, I suspect not. Michael Binion, we have, of course, seen a few similar straws in the wind in the last week or so, the announcement that where various EU agencies will be relocated to once they and all their jobs and revenue are removed from the United Kingdom. Is anything of that sort, do you think, likely to actually register with Brexiteers or change, if not even change their minds and at least give them pause for thought?
No, for the hardline Brexiteers, absolutely nothing will register except total financial meltdown.
But at least we're
you know, in charge of our own meltdown and not somebody else doing it.
It's a British meltdown.
Yeah, exactly. I think there are a whole lot of things where all but the most diehard have said, actually, we need this, such as continuation in the European Nuclear Agency and European common policing policies, because obviously our interests are involved. But I don't know. Whether they'll register, I doubt it.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Michael Binion, Michael Goldfarb, thank you both very much for joining us. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Daphne Karnesis and Alessio Dallana. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next at 1900. Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns tomorrow at 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.